No difference. The table went on moving. We subsequently learned that there had been too much psychic force at first with three of us. The mysterious power was too strong to begin with. Afterwards, it did not seem to matter. After our respective mothers had given several messages, a communicator came who gave her name as Fader. Arad explained that she was an ancestress of mine. She had married my great-great-grandfather. My mother had often told me about an Indian girl who married this ancestor, but you know how poor children are by frequently repeated family history? I had not taken much notice at the time. After marrying this native girl, my great-great-grandfather, William Hamilton, was not popular in India, and he made arrangements to bring Fader home to England. On their eve of starting home, she gave birth to a son, and died. She was then only 13. This was about the year 1800. Fader told me, by spelling out the words with the aid of the table, that she had been watching over me since I was born, waiting for me to develop my psychic power so that she could put me into a trance and give messages through me. I must confess that the idea of going into a trance did not appeal to me. I had hoped I might develop normal clairvoyance, and see or hear the spirits on the other side, as I had seen my mother in the brief vision, and the places that I had called the happy valleys. The idea of being controlled while in the trance condition by another personality was repugnant, so I refused, begging Fader to try and work with me in some 24 other way that would not necessitate either my losing consciousness or giving myself up either to her or any other person's control. Even though I knew who Fader was, I did not know what her character, temperament and personality were at that time. Florence, Nellie and I went on sitting at the table night after night, always receiving messages of great help and comfort in our daily lives. Sometimes they were from our mothers, but more often from Fader, who seemed to be a kind of spiritual mistress of their ceremonies. Occasionally we were asked by Fader to provide a heavier table, so that she could show her strength. We tried all kinds, even a heavy oak table with legs like a piano. It took three men to carry it into the room, but when we placed our hands upon it, it moved up and down like a featherweight. The walls of one room we sat in were distempered white. We always sat in a good but slightly subdued light, and on the white walls we often saw the forms of Fader and our other spirit friends silhouetted quite distinctly, like clearly cut shadows, which showed up perfectly against the light background. This was an interesting form of phenomena, which I have never witnessed since. For several months we lived in happy communication with those we loved on the other side. All our daily difficulties and trials, and at that period we three had our full share of them, were lightened by the knowledge that those whom we had thought were lost to us were really near and could see, hear, and help us. The very evidential nature of their many messages proved this to us. I cannot tell you what it meant to me. The proofs given us were so overwhelming. Though they might be placed in the category of trivial by some carping folk, I think that Fader and the other friends purposely chose simple tests so that we could easily verify them, and we were invariably able to do so. Chapter 8, Where Angels Fear to Tread. In the early stages of investigation, I would advise everybody to go slowly, not to try for involved or difficult tests until the guides themselves are ready to give, and we are ready to receive them. From time to time Fader would gently remind me of her desire to control me, but I always refused, and eventually she ceased to mention the subject. After some weeks of this simple, happy communication with our friends over there, who, we now felt, were very, very near, indeed, one of us happened to read somewhere that it was possible for a spirit to materialize a form that could be seen, heard, and actually felt, that one might feel the solid touch of a spirit's materialized hand. We asked Fado if she would materialize and show herself, not as a silhouette, but so that we could feel her touching us. Fado continually answered, "No, I will not do that. It is possible, it has been done often. But it is not for me or for you, at present." For a week or two this message deterred us from pressing the question further. Would that we had forgotten it altogether, for then we should have saved ourselves from a terrifying experience about which I will tell you, to illustrate one of the dangers to those who try to probe too deeply into matters in which their spirit friends may not be ready or qualified to help them. One day, in the winter of 1909, as we had a matinee, we were sitting in the afternoon for our usual table séance. We had read an account of a spirit who had materialized his hand so completely that he could shake hands with all the sitters. He had walked about. He had spoken. But what appealed to us most of all was the fact that he was solid enough to touch and to be touched. We again requested our spirit friends to give us such a wonderful experience. Again we were told, "It is not desirable. Let us risk it," we said. There was a long pause, a strange pause, and then the table began to tilt in quite a different manner from Fader's. A communicator who was strange to us spit out the following, "Your wish shall be granted." 26. We asked when, where, and how. He gave the following instructions, "Come back at dusk. Use the plain wooden chair to place your hands upon instead of the table. Kneel on the floor instead of sitting on chairs. Turn out all lights. Lock the door." After the matinee, we went out and had some tea. Full of enthusiasm, we returned at their appointed time. We locked the door, placed a plain bentwood chair in the center of their room, pulled down the blinds, and turned out the electric light. We found it impossible to make the room quite dark, as we had been told to do, because the lights from the street outside shone through the blinds, faintly illuminating the room. The light was not strong enough to enable us to distinguish objects clearly in the room, but as we knelt round the chair we could dimly see each other. I was kneeling between Florence and Nelly, the back of the chair being between them. And opposite me, Nelly was on my left, Florence on my right. Nelly was wearing a white blouse, and was in direct line with the window, so that I could see her more distinctly than anything else in the room. As we knelt and waited, we all three remarked that it was an entirely different atmosphere from that usually felt at our sittings. After kneeling for about a quarter of an hour, I noticed a peculiar reddish glow in their corner of the room, behind Florence. I asked her to turn round and see if she could distinguish anything. She did so, and at once remarked, "There's a kind of fire in there corner behind me, a little to my right. I wonder what it is?" Nelly saw the glow at the same time. Then, quite distinctly, we saw a letter D formed in the center of it. Puzzled, we inquired what it meant. The chair began to tilt, and spell out, "Death in this room." "Does the capital D stand for death, then?" we asked. "No dash, man's name, soon," was the answer. We were not very interested in this at the time, but it is a fact that on the following Monday a man whose name began with their letter D did die suddenly in that room. He was an utter stranger to us, so that their message had no personal significance for us. Probably he was ill at the time of their sitting, and the spirit people knew it was bound to end fatally and wanted to show us that they knew things that were unknown to us, even though very often they are not permitted to tell us about them. Well, the glow faded, Nothing else happened and we became rather impatient. "Is that all?" we asked. "Can't we feel something, as you promised we should?" "Very well," came the answer, "remain still." Our knees ached with the hard floor. We fidgeted. I began to feel it a rather uninteresting séance. Then, suddenly, I became aware of something standing between Nelly and myself. I did not see or hear anything at this point, but the air near me seemed filled by something unpleasant, something that pressed against me. I looked for a cause, but could see nothing, only feel the invisible but tangible something. "Don't become imaginative," I said to myself. I then happened to glance in Nelly's direction again. On her right shoulder, the one nearest to me, I saw a small black patch. As I looked, it lengthened gradually. It grew longer and then took on a curved shape which extended from her right shoulder across the upper part of her chest. Just then the light through the blind became a little stronger, and the line across Nelly grew plainer. I then saw that it was not a shadow or mark, but an arm. Not an arm like yours or mine, but a much longer, thinner arm, of a darkish color, and it was covered with hairs. I wondered if I should tell Nelly what I could see. As I hesitated, I saw the arm moving upwards towards her neck. Becoming excited myself, I was yet anxious not to startle Nelly, so made an effort to speak quietly and naturally to her. I got no further than, "Nelly, there's an," when she jumped up with a piercing shriek, knocked over the chair, pushed us both to one side, and rushed blindly for their door, which she shook violently, forgetting in her terror that it was locked. Florence had the presence of mind to find the switch and turn on the electric light. Nelly was in a pitiable condition, white as a sheet, and trembling from head to foot. After she had calmed down a little, we asked her what had frightened her. She told us she had been aware of the middle dot, same pressure that I had felt, and knew that something was laid on her shoulder and chest, but had waited to see what would happen. Then, suddenly, she felt the weight transferred to her throat, and it gave her such a feeling of intense fear that she could bear it no longer. Her nerves gave way and she rushed to the door, her only coherent thought being to escape from whatever it was that touched her. We talked things over calmly and sensibly, and came to the conclusion that we had been taught a well-deserved lesson, for we had been warned. In a very humbled frame of mind, we returned to the table the following Monday, very 28, chastened in spirit, and wondering if we should be forgiven for our dangerous curiosity, which had brought about such a frightening experience, and we were very glad to think that we were going to get into touch again with the spirit people we knew and trusted. When we sat round the table in our usual way, Feda came and told us that she knew we had learnt our lesson and would profit by it, also that she had an important announcement to make. It was to the effect that I ought to start developing immediately as a trance medium, and that she, Feda, was going to control me so that she could give through me messages from those who had passed over. By this time I felt that I really knew Feda so well, and loved and trusted her as I had been able to trust very few people on earth, that it seemed absurd and ungrateful to persist in denying her the opportunity of carrying out the work she wished to do, simply because of a personal prejudice, which was probably without any real foundation. So I agreed to let her entrance me, and asked her what I was to do to help it on. She told me just to go on sitting with two or three friends round a table, and that I should later on go into trance quite easily and naturally. We sat in this way for several months, but nothing happened. I did not feel anything of the extraordinary symptoms I half expected to feel. I became rather hopeless about it. But Feda encouraged me and said it would surely come in time, But that my former objections to trance were acting as a subconscious inhibition to her control of my mind. She also told me that I should have to work professionally, because if I worked only with a narrow circle of friends, a great number of people would never hear of me, or be able to come and receive help through me. I told Feder I should not like to be paid for helping people in this way. She reminded me that clergymen and doctors were paid for helping people, and that I must give up my whole time to her work, not just the odd hours I could spare from other duties, when I might be tired and practically useless to her. There came a period when my friends, Florence and Nelly, were unable to sit with me. Circumstances compelled them to take parts in another company's the one we were in. Broke up, and my husband also had to go on tour again, leaving me alone. Page 29. Chapter 9. The threads are drawn more tightly. I felt I must not waste time, and thought of a sign I had seen over a doorway while shopping one morning. This sign indicated that meetings, lectures, and spiritualistic circles were held within on certain evenings, so I went inside and saw a man who was in charge of the little building, and asked him if he knew of a developing circle. He told me there was one held every Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock, and after I had told him of my desire to develop, he suggested that I might attend the next meeting. So, at a few minutes to 8, the following Tuesday, I found myself in a small room furnished only with a round mahogany table which had about 7 or 8 chairs drawn up close to it. In the room there were about half a dozen people, the man I had met previously, who I now discovered to be a kind of president of the circle, a serious young man, looking as if he might be a bank clerk or something of the kind, a short, spectacled man of uncertain age, and 3 women. I only remember one of the women. She was stout, about 45 or 50, with a kind motherly face. I never heard their names, and cannot remember if I gave them mine, but they welcomed me into their circle in a most friendly way. There was an atmosphere of simple, kindly good fellowship, and I felt at my ease at once. We sat round the table. The lights were turned down, but not out. A very fine prayer was given by the president, in which he asked that all those present should be helped to develop their psychic gifts in the best possible way, so that they might be used for their benefit and upliftment of all with whom they came into contact. After this invocation, we sat quietly for a little while. Suddenly I felt a tingling in my hands, which were resting lightly upon the table. There, tingling spread through my wrists, up my arms, then began in my feet and legs, till my whole being felt as if filled by a gentle electric current. Then came a strange feeling in my head, a pressure on my temples as of a band tied round them, and also on top of the head. The pressure ceased, and I felt a curious force pulling me up from my chair, impelling me to stand. What I was to do in the event of my standing up I seemed incapable of imagining. It was like a dream in which I was neither conscious nor unconscious, but yet aware that somebody outside myself urged me to do one thing at a time, telling me not to try to think what the sequence of events might be. I was drawn up onto my feet by this strange magnetic power which seemed to operate from just above my head. My mouth opened, a sound issued from my lips. What it was I do not know, for at that moment the president touched me on the hand, saying, "All 30. Right, friend, don't worry, you'll be able to speak in a moment or two." He was addressing the spirit who he knew was trying to control me, but I stupidly thought he was speaking to me. That, and the touch on my hand, broke the spell. All sense of magnetic control left me. I became my normal self again, and hurriedly sat down in my chair, feeling that I had made myself ridiculous to no purpose. Suddenly the serious young man who was sitting on my right-hand side began to tremble violently. He shook as with an ague. I could see he was beginning to feel there. Same impulse to stand up that I had had. After a few moments he rose to his feet. His whole bearing was changed. An extraordinary beauty and dignity crept over his rather commonplace features. Literally, one would not have recognized him as being the same individual who had sat at that table 5 minutes before. A loud, sonorous, but very melodious voice, quite unlike his own thin, colorless tones, came from his mouth, speaking in a strange language, which one of the other sitters recognized as Hindustani. The entranced man turned to me. A flow of words, which, of course, I could not understand, was directed to me. He made many wonderful and graceful gestures with his body, hands and arms, quite unlike any movements he was ever likely to make in his ordinary life, I feel sure. After he had finished speaking, the sitter who had apparently understood much of what had been said, told me that the controlling spirit had explained that he was an Indian priest who had died many years ago, and had been trying vainly, for a long time, to control the young man. He said that I and my would-be control had a lot of power, and that when the attempt to control me was interrupted, the great amount of psychic force around me was diverted and directed by the guides in his direction. Then the stout, middle-aged woman sank back in her chair. Her body seemed to shrink to half its size. Her face lost its lines and took on the shape and curves of that of a young child. Presently, from the lips of this sensible-looking, motherly body came there tiny piping of a little girl's voice. She addressed several of the sitters, describing various spirits who were present, and then she turned to me. You have power. You have a work to do, but you are not prepared to do this work in the way your guides wish you to do it. I thought guiltily of my objections to being a professional medium. You must do this work. Tomorrow you will have a letter. Great trouble comes in it. A very troubled, difficult time follows it, but when you are prepared to do what is required of you, all will be well. The letter comes from a place a long distance away. I could not think of any immediate trouble that was likely to befall me, so the message did not impress me very much at the time. Directly I awoke next morning, I opened my few letters. The first I read was from my husband, telling me he had lost his position through no fault of his own, but by a combination of unfortunate circumstances which had arisen very unexpectedly, and that he was coming back to London immediately. 31. All our plans were upset. We removed to a place far away from Florence and Nelly. Everything went wrong. My husband's health became worse, his voice too. It was a period of the greatest privation, during which we did any kind of hard manual labor which could be obtained. Though it was extremely difficult to do so, I felt that at all costs I must remain in London, in the hope that Florence, Nelly and I might meet again. So when my husband got the offer of a special fortnight's engagement in the provinces, I remained in town because I had a very strong premonition that something of importance was going to happen while my husband was absent. The day following his departure, I met a woman whom I knew very slightly, and she asked me if I happened to know anybody who would walk on in a huge spectacular show that was just going to be put on in a large West End theatre. I had a curious feeling that I must suggest myself. She said, "Well, I didn't think you would accept their engagement, but I felt I must mention it to you." She gave me all particulars, time of rehearsals for the next day, etc. When I reached home, to my surprise there was a letter from Nelly, from whom I had not heard for a long time. She spoke of this very production, saying she had been engaged for it herself, and had already suggested my name to the producer, and asking me to call at the theatre at the same time as I had already arranged to be there. I was overjoyed at the idea of working with Nelly again, though sorry that Florence would not be there. I arrived at the theatre next morning, met Nelly, and was engaged by the producer. While waiting to see him, I was listening casually to the dozens of waiting actors and actresses chattering, when my ear singled out one voice from all the others. It seemed strangely familiar. When I looked at the speaker, I saw she was a complete stranger to me, yet I felt very much attracted to her. The show needed a great deal more rehearsing than the management had expected. In fact, the rehearsals went on for some weeks, instead of the original fortnight that was arranged. During the rehearsals, Nelly and I made friends with the lady whose voice had attracted me. To our astonishment, we found that she had some experience in psychical research, and was extremely interested in the whole subject. This drew their three of us very close. We told her, I will call her Agnes, about our table sittings, and how Feda had said she was going to control me, and that I had eventually agreed to let her do so, but she had not yet been able to do it. Agnes suggested that we should try again, though it seemed impossible in such conditions, and see if Feda could entrance me. Chapter 10, Feda achieves her object. Where could we sit, in that vast, noisy building? There was no suitable place in there. Overcrowded dressing room, or any part of the building as far as I could see. I must tell you that in our early sittings, Florence, Nelly and myself were always fortunate enough to have a dressing room to ourselves, and we used to make their conditions as harmonious as we possibly could, by not discussing unpleasant or worldly matters just before our sitting, and by singing softly the hymns that seemed to be suitable for our purpose. Feda always chose Abide With Me. We often sang it several times in the evening, and at the words, Where is death's sting, where grave thy victory, some sign would always be given us of her presence, even if there had been a temporary blank in the sitting previously. Dressing among this crowd of chattering girls was therefore a new experience to us. And we all three agreed that it was impossible to attempt sitting there. We used to wander about the theatre, looking for a quiet spot. It seemed hopeless, till one night we discovered a very steep, narrow staircase leading down from the stage. We climbed down it, though actually we had no right to do so, and found ourselves in a large deserted place, among all the different engines and machinery that were used for the heating, lighting and other purposes of the theatre. Not a soul was in sight, and there walls and ceiling were so thick that we could hear very little except the muffled thud-thud of the engines. We found a clean corner, which seemed a veritable haven of peace. After all the noise and chatter up above, my husband, who had returned from there provinces and luckily been engaged for the production just before it opened, obtained a table and three Windsor chairs for us. We took them down the stairs with all secrecy, desperately hoping we should not be discovered. Between 9 and 10 o'clock we had a wait, so we determined to sit every evening at this time. We did so, and were delighted when Feda spelt messages out through the table in her old familiar style. She reminded me that she was going to control me as soon as possible, and also said that Agnes, Nelly and I had been guided to this theatre so that we might sit and investigate together. I told her that I was now only too eager for her to entrance me, and she said she would do so as soon as she could, but night after night passed and though she assured me that she was trying her best to accomplish it, She seemed to make no headway at all. Agnes and Nelly were sporting